Today, I'm happy to bring you a sneak preview of the first episode of When Change Happens, a podcast series about ordinary South Africans coping with extraordinary changes in their lives and hosted by legendary journalist Ruda Luntman. To hear the rest, subscribe to When Change Happens on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Iono, or go to changepodcasts.co.za for more information.
I knew I had a problem. I knew there was something bad coming. A crystal meth downer is beyond depression. There's a hole in your soul. I was like, is this really who I am? I just stopped the drugs on the Sunday.
Welcome to When Change Happens, a podcast about moments that change our lives. Moments that can happen to any of us and do happen to many of us. In this episode, we speak to Costa, whose change was a journey from addiction to recovery and then, delightfully, to comedy. We also chat with our resident change scientist, Dr. Frank Mukwege, whose sensitive scientific perspective will shed some light on Costa's journey. And it really is a very full, long journey that began some 40 years ago. You started drinking as a teenager.
1 year younger, 12, was the first time I got drunk, yeah.
But you still excelled through high school and university. You were a completely functioning alcoholic. But there was a moment there that sounded to me as if it was a possible change moment, but you didn't take it in that way when you were hijacked.
So, yes, I was, when I was hijacked, it happened when most people, I mean, had never heard of hijackings. It was 1992. In fact, nobody believed me, you know, I mean, we didn't have cell phones those days or whatever. It was a nightmare to get found again on the side of the highway. But after my hijack, it was just before my final year exams of my honors year at varsity. I didn't have time to process it. I had to study. It was about passing my exams. So I threw myself into my studies. And then as soon as that finished, it was time to celebrate. And celebration equals joy and mirth and fun. And with it came a lot of alcohol. So it literally, you know, it was December. I wasn't about to fall apart. I was about to have fun.
How did it affect you emotionally?
How it affected me was I moved towns. I went to get a good job somewhere else. I lived in Durban and life started happening. I needed to work hard. I had a new career on the go. I was facing my identity crisis. Am I gay? Am I not gay? And all this confusion layered with the trauma of gun violence, because I was, you know, not just hijacked, I was taken along for a ride and had to, you know, beg for them to let me go. And finally, after a while, they did, with a car running low on petrol. And finally, when I was in Durban, I fell apart because unresolved trauma has a way of coming back up. And while I had a moment to look at my life and examine it when the hijack had happened, I didn't. And depression is a, you know, the body's coping mechanism of shutting down so that you can deal with it. So depression came to visit me and the fog came and set in to a point where I stopped functioning. I couldn't get to work on time. I drank more and more. And finally, I had a fantastic boss who noticed something, and we got HR in on the matter. And that's when the first look at my life, introspection happened.
Well, you said in a previous interview that you were so drunk at work one day, you fell off the chair in front of the boss.
That was an embarrassing moment. Actually, what happened was, and I have no junkie pride around it. It is shameful to even think about it. But I went out through the night and I lost my house keys. So I just fell asleep in my car and then just went to work the next day in the night before's clothing. And as I walked into the office, still drunk from the night before, I fell over the chair onto the floor. And that's when HR had to come and sort this mess out.
And that that sent you into therapy, but you were not ready to confront the problem with alcohol.
Because the identity problem for me was way bigger in my head. My therapist said that I have a very troubling relationship with alcohol. And I wasn't ready to listen to. He was a bookish guy who didn't understand what it was like to have fun. I have lots of friends and that's who I am. I'm very social. But he did help me look at me being gay, understanding it, assimilating it, and also sharing it with the world. So that was a great win, but it didn't help me with the alcohol, no.
But I also hear something about the way you, almost your identity, that you were a party animal. You were a happy person out there, and you were not going to question that.
No, it was a very big part of my identity. So the social Costa, the one who wanted everybody to like him and who wanted to be seen. It is also very easy in South Africa to get away with drinking on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday sundowners. Before you know it, you're drinking 4 or 5 days a week.
Listening to Costa, I'm struck by his resistance to change, and I'm curious about what's behind that. So I asked Dr. Frank. It sounds to me as if Costa, there were prompts for him to change, but he shoved it to the back of the cupboard every time until there came, it kind of built up. This was what, maybe the hijack was the first one, but
yes.
This interaction and then the therapy that would follow,
yes,
that was a major prompt. And the next one built on this. Does that often happen, that a person it needs more than one prompt
absolutely.
To get to change?
I think, you know, your dissatisfaction may be there, but it's not high enough.
Dissatisfaction. In a way, it's as simple as that. We have to be dissatisfied enough with things in order to change them. And despite several prompts to change, Costa was not dissatisfied enough to actually start changing.
Even though the prompts are coming, you still have higher levels of resistance. You're just saying, what's in for me? There's no need for me, you know, to change. And so what's interesting about it is once something bigger happens, as in here the hijack and then the falling over, you know, the chair, often the person looks back and actually realizes, you know, there were these moments of change, and that gives a stronger resolve to say, you know, I missed those moments, I could have and avoided this.
So Costa didn't act on those prompts to change. In fact, his addiction became deeper. And then you started using drugs. How did that happen?
So I've always been against drugs. I was scared of them. I've always been scared of them. And I always told my friends, I must never try them because I know I'm going to love them. I know there's something in me that doesn't have an off button. And life on life terms happened. I went through a breakup. I was feeling upset and sad about the breakup and also felt free from the breakup. And right place, wrong time, wrong place, wrong time. Somebody offered me some cat. Cat is something that you inhale, make a line and take through your nostril. I'd never done that before. I was like, what can it do?
How bad can it be?
How bad can it be? And I had the first night, and then I phoned my friend the next day and I said, you don't understand. I absolutely loved it. I was like, what if I get hooked? He's like, oh, relax. It's just one line. And I knew. I mean, I said something and I write about this in my book. And a lot of addicts will tell you that when you have your first line, your first hit of the hard drugs, the first thought that went through my mind and what a lot of people say is, where have you been all my life? It's this finally something to turn off the pain and begins this so-called love affair with drugs, where the drugs lie to you, where you use them until they start using you.
What does that mean?
So I used drugs and I used cocaine and cat until the drugs start using you. In other words, they say, okay, well, thanks for the cocaine. You're using me, but that's not enough. How about you try a bit more of this and a bit more of that? And before you know it, you're always trading up to a harder drug. And then when a drug is using you, you are powerless over it. It takes over your life, and that's all you actually want. And that's when the drugs are using you.
What was happening practically in your life? Could you still carry on work, and you had your own business? How did you manage that?
So drugs are, oh gosh. What happened is I had to find a way to survive, and I also had to find a way to enjoy, I told myself. So I decided to lead almost two separate lives. The one where I was exceptionally responsible, did what I was supposed to do, got bills paid on time, got my businesses going, et cetera, et cetera. And the other side of me was like, okay, let's just have some fun and let's contain the fun. I'd done it throughout varsity. You know, I was either drunk or I was studying. Like, I knew how to keep the two separate. But unfortunately, the drugs are so strong, they start taking over. So the Friday, Saturday, Sunday binges became Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is more than half the week. And then what happens is thanks to the drugs making your life chaotic and bringing this unmanageability into your life, things start going wrong. You bump your car, you lose your cell phone, you leave your card in the card machine. You start doing some grandiose things also. Grandiosity is another big thing. I didn't lose my money to drugs, because even though drugs are expensive, I lost my money to big business decisions, big holidays I went on, things that I shouldn't have been doing. You know, recklessness creeps in. And I managed to keep the two pretty separate. I also had two different groups of friends, and I kept them both separate as well. And it's not sustainable.
But then there was a change moment. What happened?
So, unfortunately, well, I don't say unfortunately, because fortune has favored me all my life. And this is where fortune favored me. I found crystal meth. Crystal meth in the early 2000s was super expensive. It didn't have its rough derivatives like tuck, etc. out yet. I managed to find some. In fact, in those days, I found a dealer who could deliver it to my house. So this was before Uber Eats, okay? And the first time he delivered it to my house, I knew I had a problem. I knew there was something bad coming, because now I didn't even have to leave home to get high.
So here are the beginnings, stirrings of some dissatisfaction.
Crystal meth is a mood and mind-altering drug that after doing enough of it for a couple of months, a psychosis comes over you, where you start seeing things that are not there. And I was seeing things that were definitely not there. There were cops outside my house. They weren't even there. I would go out with some friends. I wouldn't use for a couple of days, and I'd go out with some friends, and I'd walk up to a complete bunch of strangers and greet them as if I knew them, and they would look at me like, "Are you okay?" You know, and I'd be like, "No, I'm sure I know you." They're like, "No, we've never seen you before," and I knew them, and stories were being made up in my head. People were out to get me. My ex was lying to me.
Now here is greater awareness of growing dissatisfaction.
And, you know, there's a psychosis and a delusion that creeps in, to the point where I found myself desperate on a Sunday night. The drugs were about to finish, and I felt possessed. It was a possession. Call it what you like, a demonic possession, something else. I felt like I was no longer in control of my life. The drugs were now making the decisions. I had lied to my then partner. I had cheated a few people, and I started looking around my apartment. The money had dried up, and I started saying, and then the drugs said, right, we can start selling things. Let's start selling the TV. Let's start selling. Maybe we can sell the house, get an extra bond, et cetera, et cetera. And I couldn't stop it. There was a possession that came over me that frightened me. And that change moment came from a moment of fear. And fear is not a strong enough word. Horror. A horror that I officially could no longer run my life. I had no ability to do what I wanted to do. The drugs were doing me.
Now the dissatisfaction has become undeniable and intense. And then came a moment when Costa was at an ATM.
it all happened in that one foggy weekend where I went to go draw money and there was no money left. And that's when the drug said, we can start selling things. So I was like, okay, I'm going to become that guy who starts selling his stuff. And then we all know where that goes. Then you become that guy who starts borrowing money. Then you're the guy who can't pay the money back. Then you're the guy who people come after you. And I played out this movie in my mind. And now the desperate situation gets even worse. And I just knew two things. One, I was like, I was not brought up this way. And then I went, no, hang on. Let's put upbringing aside. I don't want this for my life. Hang on a second. I'm sure there's more to my life than this. I was like, is this really who I am? And is this really who I was supposed to be? And I was like, surely there's more to me than this.
Ultimate absolute dissatisfaction, which came to a head one night.
And then the delusion and the psychosis kicks in where you feel like you're going mad. And the madness that creeps in, your brain is no longer your own and there's no money left. And my then partner confronted me. He went to the bathroom and then came back. And while I was in the bathroom, I took my last gram and I hid it. And I took another empty sack, put some sugar in there. And he came out the bathroom. I said, I'm done with drugs. And I said, look, and I poured it down the drain. Meantime, it was just sugar. So I was so crafty. I found a way to get him to go to bed so I could finish the half a gram I had left. So he went to bed thinking I'd so-called given up. And he went to bed and I just finished the drugs I had on me. And that's when the psychosis, which was happening for a couple of days, the cops came back. There were lights all around the house. I felt like they were coming for me. And I was literally on my knees looking out the window at the cops. And then my boyfriend turned on the lights. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, no, the cops are there. He's like, there aren't any cops, Costa. There's no cops. And then on your knees in front of the situation, I call it, I was given, it's not my own definition, the gift of desperation. And desperation is a magical motivator that I was so desperate in that moment to do anything that I could to never, ever, ever, ever use drugs again. So that for me now I see as a spiritual gift. And crystal meth gave it to me and desperation gave it to me. And it's how my life is so amazing right now.
But let's back up to the very beginnings of Costa's dissatisfaction. I wanted to understand how the change process started and developed from there. Dr. Frank, I was fascinated by Costa saying, when the guys started delivering the drugs, I knew this was bad. So even though he wasn't even close to the decision to giving up, to give up, part of his mind was, is that a kind of vague pre-readiness moment, stage?
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I was reflecting on that as well. And I wrote down my notes there. I was saying, you know, it's interesting how, just listen to Costa's story, there's a heightened self-awareness sense. Right, wrong. This might not end up well. But anyway, you know, I'm going to proceed and see. So definitely in this story, there is there's a kind of a low sense of pre-contemplate. You know, this thing might not end well. I think I need to change. But I think nothing major had yet happened to move from the pre-contemplation to actually the contemplation, like, no, I can't live like this. You know, where he was talking about that idea of there's got to be more in life than what's happening now. Now you were in definitely contemplation stage, yeah.
What Dr. Frank is referring to are stages of change according to one scientific model. The first two stages are pre-contemplation and contemplation, when you are thinking about making a change. The third stage is preparation, although, as we'll hear, Costa seemed to skip that and move directly to the fourth stage, action.
I just stopped the drugs on the Sunday And then I was like, I'm going to get myself into rehab. I'm going to try something. I started making phone calls. I found a rehab. I went to check myself in. They wouldn't accept me because it was a Thursday before the public holiday weekend. They said, come back next week. I was like, oh my gosh. And then I found a friend of mine who'd been in a 12-step recovery program. I called her up. I said, apparently there's groups that meet that can help me. She said, yes, here's a meeting in Forest Town. Get there. And I drove myself there. And I went to one meeting on the Thursday, and I was in a room full of people that none of them are professionals, and everybody wanted a better life, and everybody had the same problem as me. And all of us kept nodding our heads when everybody spoke because we all shared the same affliction. And I thought, hang on a second, these are my people, and this could actually work. Sure, that there's so much power in standing up in a room full of addicts saying, I am an addict. Because with it comes a sense of powerlessness, like I'm done. And saying that over and over in front of hundreds, sometimes thousands of people, and then telling your family and friends, suddenly everybody thinks you're going to stop. Now you've got to stop. And I was given so many little suggestions and tips in the first night. And the one tip was, come back tomorrow. So I held on to that. I was like, okay, it's a public holiday, long weekend. Everybody's out jawling. Just go home, turn off your phone, and come back tomorrow night. And I literally, the fear of using again and the horror of that empty space. A crystal meth downer is beyond, it's beyond depression. There's an emptiness that is, the way other people describe it is there's a hole in your soul. Now, that's not sadness. A hole in your soul means there's nothing. You are nothing. And I never wanted to feel that again. And the horror of that creeping back in kept me at home, in bed, sleeping until the next meeting. I had more people in my phone who wanted to help me stop using drugs than people who wanted to use with me. And then they were like, come back tomorrow. And I did. And then a few hundred tomorrows later, things started working.
And a few hundred tomorrows later, Costa was in the next stages of change. Stage 5, relapse, or dealing with the risk of relapse. And stage 6, maintaining the change. These last two stages are about making change stick. And it was this part of Costa's change journey that I really wanted to unpack with Dr. Frank, starting with the room full of people that Costa spoke about.
The idea of accountability partner is so interesting, and they don't even need to be professionals. You feel you get more value through interacting with someone who has gone through or is going through that which you want to quit, which you want to get out. They are a more relatable person. The one thing, and it comes out in Costa's story, is that they were like me. They were struggling with the same thing. They are relatable. That's the first thing. So a relatable accountability partner, you know, kind of works wonders in that sense. Then there's another magic here. It's not one individual. Group accountability. What happens is, if all these people talking about their journey, and just the way the brain works, you almost feel accountable to the group and to the individual members. And you think, yo, if I come across this one, they find me doing this, what would they say? Because I was in the meeting with them, right? So you have two layers of accountability. At an individual level, you're identifying with other people there, and at a group level.
So being supported by others and being held accountable to others, this was a huge part of helping Costa stay sober. Still, wasn't the temptation to relapse always there? How does one deal with that? Because surely it must be, it's part of the journey.
So I haven't relapsed myself, and relapse is a part of recovery. Everybody's journey is different. I can't bear how people shame people who've relapsed. I cannot imagine the pain of relapsing, where you've got a body full of drugs and a mind full of recovery. That is beyond torturous. My heart goes out to people who relapse, because nobody wants to be a crystal meth addict. Nobody. And I don't want to be a using addict. If I could If I could help myself in that moment, I would have. But a lot of people, they can't. And so my empathy for using addicts is huge. My understanding is also huge. I'm super tough on using addicts. But in terms of relapse, it hasn't been in my journey. It's part of many of my friends' journeys, four of which died from relapse. And when each time if somebody dies, it makes me want to work harder at carrying a message of understanding, of empathy, of hope, because it makes their lives not in vain.
Did you have a picture of where you might be when all of this is over? Because it must have been absolute hell physically going through that. Mm. Did you have a picture of in 6 months' time, in a year's time?
So the program talks about just for today, and gratefully just for today, because if you told me that I would never be allowed to have another drink again or never do, maybe not taking drugs, I would have said, okay, I'll do that. But what do you mean I can't have champagne at my friend's wedding or whatever? And the thought is, let's not discuss that. Let's just think about today. Can I get through today without having a drink? Yes. Can I get through? Sometimes it's not just for today, sometimes just for this minute or just for this hour. But can I get through the next hour? Yes. And then the next hour, and then the next hour, and then apply some of the spiritual gifts and exercises. And before you know it, the day's over. And you start again. So I didn't have a picture of what I looked like in 2 weeks' time because that was too far away. And those first 30 days, the first 30 days feels like a mountain. And then before you know it, then the 60 and then 90, etc.
And it's now how long?
So I don't like saying how long for a simple reason is it is just for today. And I will tell you how long. I just want to drive the point home that I, for two reasons, how long isn't as important to me because today I have the option to drink and use. It'll always be an option. It is all around me. And life on life's terms may mean I may want that again. So I am clean just for today. A couple of just for todays in a row made it 18 years on the 9th of April.
I found this, pardon the word choice, sobering. Because the way Costa just stopped using one day, it almost sounds like it was easy. But it definitely wasn't easy. It was an accumulation of lots of very small steps taken one at a time. One day, 1 hour at a time.
Spot on, Rudan. And a lot of change, science, research on change supports what he's saying. The biggest stumbling block on people's change journeys is the realization it's too much, it's too big. Who am I to think I can achieve this? Right? It's daunting, it's overwhelming. There's a book by the title Tiny Habits by a Stanford professor, BJ Fogg, and he makes it vivid as follows. He says he realized he never believed in flossing, and then he went to the dentist, and the dentist told him that no, you're brushing okay, but there are places where the brush doesn't get to, you need to floss. He couldn't, this is a whole professor, he couldn't bring himself to floss. You know what he did, Ruda? He writes it in his book, Tiny Habits. He started one tooth at a time. One evening he pat himself on the back and on until it became a habit. And that actually was the genesis of his book, Tiny Habits. And so a lot has been written around small steps. And their power is a psychological power that says, my goodness, I've achieved something. You break a big change into small bits. That's first part of it, right? My goodness, I've achieved something. Then it's got another underlying mechanism again. So the first is gratitude. I believe I can do it. And you then do something very interesting. You pat yourself on the back. Patting yourself on the back is self-compassion. So when you break a big change into little bits and say, yeah, I'm doing it, you pat yourself on the back, what's also happening? You're developing self-control. You're kind to yourself. You're saying, I know change is hard, but actually I'm doing well. I'm not going to talk harshly to myself if I do have a relapse or things don't go well, because my goodness, there is this accumulation of small wins. And that's the magic. Often we set ourselves for failure when we want to achieve something overnight, a big thing. And what happens? We don't achieve it. We talk harshly to us and we just stop. So small habits work in this way of constantly encouraging us, and we develop self-compassion, which is needed for change.
And this idea, this method of taking small steps, was something Costa used again later to make another kind of change. And that was about exercise and training. You had never done much as a youngster.
Nothing.
And then you, what? You ran round one block. Why?
I was that guy who'd come home from the jaw and all the cyclists would go past us while I was chain smoking. I mean, what are these oaks doing on a Sunday morning? Are they mad? And at the time, my partner picked up some running and actually used to be a runner. So he was like, he went mad. He was like, he wanted to do the comrades. I thought, okay, he's being absolutely ridiculous. And if you've ever been involved with a comrades runner, unless you're running with them, you don't see them. So after a couple of months clean, what also happens is you start waking up before your alarm clock. You start having so much free time on your hands. You also have energy that I didn't have before. So I was like, oh, bugger it, let me just join him on a run. And I did. I got up the one day, put on some clubbing shoes and ran around the block. Well, I ran what felt like the biggest marathon of my life. And after I measured it the next day, it was only 700 meters. But I was, uitgeput is the best Afrikaans word I can think of. I was like completely wasted, exhausted, flattened, like... And what happened was I got some free drugs. They're called endorphins. And I was like, oh, this feels quite nice. And there was a lightheadedness that is fun, but the clarity was great. The sun was a little bit brighter. The birds made a little bit more of a sweeter sound. Traffic wasn't as bad. Endorphins calmed my soul. I went for a run the next day. And then after a couple of runs later, I started running further and further. And it's a metaphor for my recovery one day at a time, you know, 1 meter, 1 block at a time. I then set my sight on my biggest goal, which was a 5 kilometer race. And I trained for 3 months and I finished in, I think, like 50 minutes. I can't remember how long. But I managed to trot at least the whole way. And that 5K run was my marathon. And it starts like that. And, you know, I'd learned that with incremental gains come some fantastic feats. And that's where my fitness journey started, with very small changes that I made in my life.
And you have done what? 3 whole Ironmans and 11 half, or the other way around?
That's it. No, that's it. 11 half Ironman and 3 Ironman. I did 5 years of triathlon.
So Costa got physically fit, but he also stayed change fit. And then another different chapter, but this time professionally, you also decided for some reason that you wanted to be a stand-up comic.
So I had another much more creative aspiration. I felt inside of me there was a writer, a performer, and I knew he was there. And what happens is when you spend time alone and you spend time introspecting, actually the story of how I became a comedian is quite funny. I decided to go and spend 3 days doing a silent retreat. I was alone, silence, nobody around me, and nothing to read or write. I just sat and I was in the bush alone. And all I remember was I found myself really very funny. I couldn't stop laughing. I was clumsy. I kept banging my head everywhere and knocking things over. And I would make stories in my mind about the bees in the tree. And there was just a lot of laughter came out of me. There was a lot of joy and laughter inside of me. I was like, gee whiz, I find the world a very funny place. And I find myself really funny. So that's when I said, well, if I find myself so funny, why don't I write some jokes and try and make myself laugh? And then I started doing some stand-up comedy. Then I wrote a book. The book was very cathartic, but the book couldn't help but also be funny. And I have a very funny style of writing and also a very funny way of looking at my life. And after it got published, I revisited comedy and speaking, sharing my story and doing it through comedy, through the lens of lightness, just to give myself a break and give to others in the audience a break too, about, you know, let's also normalize mental health. Let's normalize having been a crystal meth addict.
Yes, Costa, but many people have a vague dream of maybe I can get on a stage and have an audience applaud me. Very few people actually follow through.
With enough introspection, my voice inside of me is much louder than all the voices outside.
What do the voices outside say? Because that's really the resistance to the change.
The voices outside are full of doubt, fear. Of course they come back and they creep in. Of course I have self-doubt. Of course I have incredible imposter syndrome sometimes. Those are healthy. Those are telling me something is scary. And if something is scary, maybe it's worth going on an adventure. And clearly I have an adventurous soul. Clearly I have a slightly mad condition. And I do love the thrill. And if I'm not going to get it from drugs, why not get it from pushing myself a little bit further in something that I have a dream in?
It's also, what I'm also hearing is a very strong feeling that I can, or I can at least try.
The voices inside say, of course I can do it. There's a small delusion that creeps in. And I also hear my mother saying, just do it. Come on. You've got this. My inner voice saying, what's the worst that can happen? You know, the worst thing that can happen is you can try and fail at a dream. I mean, I've been through much worse in my life. I've nearly died hundreds of times. This is not trauma or drama. This is fun. And listening to those voices inside of me, they say, come on, you can do it. Or what's the worst that can happen?
There are two things here that I found fascinating that I asked Dr. Frank about. The one is, you will not get to making a change without first stopping.
Yes.
Giving yourself space. The contemplation.
Yes.
Is the word that has been come up, has been coming up. And then the other is the self-belief that you have to in some, and so many people just do not have that.
No, spot on. So your first point, it's so interesting. It's such an interesting observation that we often don't realize, because we are accustomed to a society that's just say run, run, run. People don't value thinking and reflection. We value more doing. We put more weight on doing. You know, that's why people tell you, look at how many emails I receive. Have you seen my calendar? Because they're bragging about doing, 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 right? And so it's amazing to listen to Costa and just connect the dots. There is something about stopping, reflecting. I mean, the 3-day retreat in the bush, it made me realize I'm very funny. And. So there's so much going on just around his general self-awareness. Like, it's a person who seems to be quite good at this skill, or give them time. Pause, reflect, make sense what's going on, then I can, you know, decide what to do next. And we all need it on a change. We need to stop doing. Because sometimes we keep on doing things that are not going to give us the results. Yet we need to change. So stop, reflect. And then your second point, I think it speaks a little bit to I guess personality. People come with different gifts. He uses the word spiritual gifts and gifts in general a lot, Costa. Just that some people have a little bit more higher levels of confidence. I can do it, you know, before the world tells you you can do it. So he says the voices inside me, they definitely say, of course you can do it. What's the worst can happen? And of course, it's not to say that if someone is perhaps little bit lower levels of that they can't navigate change. It's about being aware. And if you realize maybe that kind of inner drive, you don't have perhaps lots of it, like a Costa, for example. That's where, Ruda, our conversation earlier around social support comes in. Like my mom, Costa says, she says you can do it. It's sharing with other people what you're trying to achieve. You'll be amazed, even someone who's got a little bit of self-doubt in themselves, once they tell the world, they are shocked to realize how much other people believe in themselves. Other people believe more in themselves than they do. So that's a technique, you know, one can use if they have a little bit of self-doubt, they're not sure they can do it, maybe high levels of imposters. Share that audacious goal with people. Tell them what you want to achieve, and you'll be amazed how they believe in you, and that propels you forward.
To end off, I asked Costa what his lasting takeout was. So what is the one thing, do you think, that has enabled you to maintain this path that you've taken?
For me, the secret is the power of incremental gains.
Two things that I will remember from this story, I think, are that change is enmeshed with how we see ourselves, with a vision of who I am and who I want to be in this world, much more than what do I want to do. He didn't change, well, he did change because he didn't want to do the crystal meth anymore, but there was also the, this is not who I am. So that's the one thing. And the other thing is the power of incremental change, the small habits.
Tiny habits.
Just start for today.
Yeah.
Do not start with the 5-year goal. Start with today. Are you expecting some change or dealing with change right now? What change might be just around the corner? And most importantly, how ready are you for when change happens? Well, now you can find out and quantify scientifically how change-ready you are. Get your change-ready score in minutes by visiting changeexchange.co.za.
We created the Change Exchange because at BrightRock, we love change. And we wanted to know and share everything there is to know about change and how it impacts our lives. We call it Change Science. Change Science shows that everyone can get better at navigating change and that in all moments of change, there's always opportunity. To learn more about Change Science, visit the Change Exchange, our free resource that's filled with tips, tools, and inspiring stories to help you navigate change in your life. Just like the stories in this podcast, you can find many more on changeexchange.co.za or on your preferred podcast platform. Just search for Change Exchange. Made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.